And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today on the program, we're going to be talking to Gloria LaRiva. She is with the Free the Five Committee of the United States. And there is going to be a tribunal, as our listeners well know, Breaking the Silence, Justice for the Cuban Five, People's Tribunal and Assembly. It's going to be held in Toronto, September the 21st through the 23rd. And there will be registration, which is going to be begin on the 21st. We'll get into the details about all that when we speak to Gloria LaRiva. Later in the show, we're going to talk to Robin Philpott in Montreal about the recent election in Quebec and also the student movement, which has been the most massive and dramatic and powerful student demonstrations and strike in the history of North America, actually. And we want to know the consequences of all that. And we'll, at the end of the program, at the latter part, we will be talking to Stephen Gowans about Canada's decision to close the Iranian embassy and what the consequences are going to be. But now we have with us Gloria LaRiva. Are you there?
Yes. How are you?
How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for taking the time, Gloria. We're looking forward to seeing you in Toronto on the 21st of September. The conference you're attending has got a number of people from all over the world, and the title of it is Breaking the Silence, Justice for the Cuban Five. Let's talk about what is the silence. What is it that Americans, Canadians, and people around the world have not been able to learn about this dramatic case of the five Cubans?
Well, despite the fact that the Cuban Five case involved U.S.-Cuba relations and the matter of five men who've been in prison for 14 years, their anniversary is Wednesday of their arrest, it's a case that's hardly known in the U.S. press, and it has taken a great deal of struggle for any coverage to take place, precisely because the United States conducted a political trial in Miami of these five men who were in Miami in the early 1990s protecting their country of Cuba from years of attacks by terrorist groups that reside in Miami, and the Cuban Five were infiltrated into those groups and preventing terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. government arrested them, put them on trial in a city where the right-wing extreme organizations that have carried out literally hundreds of attacks against Cuba and within Miami as well, against anyone who calls for normalization of relations with Cuba, the U.S. arrested the men who were stopping the terrorism, and that's where we're at. It's U.S. policy.
It is very striking, I mean, that you have so many outstanding individuals, both from the world of film and theater and literature and some major political figures who've spoken out, but their voices is as though they've been put on mute by someone. I wonder if you could talk about that aspect. That, for example, there's a new matter that is being brought to the attention, I guess, of the courts, which is that there wasn't really a proper trial in the sense that there was external manipulation of the process involving the media, which is, I guess, what we're talking about when we say silence. What was that about? How did that take place?
Well, it's hard to understand how this injustice took place, except to know that Miami is a city absolutely unique in the United States. There is no city like Miami where known, admitted, and boastful terrorists who killed people, in fact dozens of people, mm-hmm. can actually have prominent positions in that city. So during the trial of the five, they were placed on trial in November 2000. The trial took 7 months. And in the beginning of the trial, they were charged with federal charges of espionage conspiracy. For one, Gerardo Hernandez, who's serving double life, he was charged with a very outrageous charge of murder conspiracy. That's a long story. But anyway, when the defense attorneys appealed for a change of venue. They asked the judge a number of times to move the trial out of Miami because of this longstanding hostility toward Cuba. Mm-hmm. The judge refused. And so they were tried in an atmosphere of absolute prejudice in the city. The jurors were accosted virtually by the media. They would follow them to the cars, filmed their license plates, and in Miami, that means that your license plate, your address, a name is placed in the media, and many people in the past have had death threats as a result from the media in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
They were convicted in June 2001, sentenced from terms of 15 years to double life, and yet it took 5 years after the trial for this astounding fact to become known when the Miami Herald, which is the main newspaper of Miami, a reporter named Oscar Corral in 2006 revealed in an article that 10 Miami journalists were on the U.S. government payroll. They were being paid to work in radio and TV Marti, which are U.S. official propaganda stations that beam transmit, you know, propaganda against Cuba into the island. And by U.S. law, it is prohibited for those broadcasts of radio and TV Marti to be transmitted in the United States. Why? Because it's considered propaganda, and so there's a law against that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, these 10 journalists were revealed to have been working not only in Miami, but also for radio and TV Marti. Mm-hmm. So the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, of which I'm coordinator, we began a what is now over 3 years of investigation. We did a Freedom of Information Act and found, over these last 3 years, dozens of journalists in Miami who were on that payroll of the government while they covered the case of the Cuban Five during the trial, during their arrest and trial, in the most outrageous, prejudicial, harmful manner that virtually convicted them in the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's part of their current and final appeal. They're only allowed one habeas corpus appeal by U.S. law. It's very restrictive. But this is new evidence of a constitutional violation, and we think it's powerful evidence that should immediately free them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, on the matter of propaganda, I believe I read a statement from the from Mr. Alarcón of the Cuban government. There was something to do with the fact that not only were they being paid to do propaganda, but they were also being fed information, right? It had been actually the kind that ordinary journalists would not have any access to. Someone was giving them things to say and write about. Is that right?
Well, I think some of the violations by the media, besides their prejudicial coverage, was that they would be in the courtroom, and at times when the jury was taken out of the courtroom so that arguments were heard between the two parties, the defense and the prosecuting attorneys, that the jury was not supposed to hear, that was not supposed to be for them to consider, the media would publish it in the press. And keep in mind that for 7 months, the jury was not sequestered. It's very unusual for
not
a case
sequestered.
Not sequestered.
In a situation where the issue of venue had been discussed at length.
Absolutely. In a case like this, I mean, everyone knows that for criminal charges of such a serious nature, the jury would be sequestered, and yet they weren't. And in Miami, it's impossible for them not to have heard some of this information, misinformation, through neighbors, through the media. As a matter of fact, in the trial, early on in the trial, almost a month after it started, the prosecution filed a motion asking the judge to enforce her gag order on the media and on witnesses. And in that motion, the government said, paraphrasing, basically they said, well, we know that the judge instructs the jury not to read the media, and we, you know, have no reason to think that wouldn't happen still.
Mm-hmm.
There was one quote by a government witness that the government felt was harmful to their case, and they howled about this. They said it was a violation of the gag order, and they said still the jury could end up reading the media. So they admitted that the media would have an effect
mm-hmm.
in this trial. And yet now they're saying, they're arguing against a new trial, against justice for the five, against the freeing of the five, saying that the judge protected the jury from the media. We do not believe that's true. And this is why the attorneys, there's a new attorney, by the way, Martin Garbus, who has filed an extraordinary affidavit along with a memorandum of law filed by one of the other attorneys, Richard Clue. And this memorandum of law and affidavit are very powerful, a groundbreaking argument on the government's collaboration and illegal operation of such a grand scale with the media against the five.
Now, by the way, I saw that, and I believe it was on a site where you, and I should tell our listeners, this is Gloria LaRiva, and she is with the Free the Five National Committee in the USA. There is a website where that's available. Could you tell me what that is?
Our website is freethefive.org, and five is spelled out. It has an interview with Martin Garbus, which was just last week, with Geraldo Rivera. He's a very well-known commentator. Mm-hmm. And there's a series of five articles by the president of Cuba's National Assembly, Ricardo Alarcón, who you mentioned before. He's writing an analysis and denunciation of this whole process of the government in having paid these journalists. It's, I think, the most important issue for the public to know. Our feeling is that this evidence should not just remain within the legal realm in the courtroom. It has to be brought out. We're so appreciative that you're having this mm-hmm. interview, that you're letting us, the public, know about it. And for politicians, personalities that you've said are going to be at the conference, people around the world, juridical circles, for everyone to demand that the U.S. bring justice by freeing the five, and to show that not only should there be justice, but also the appearance of justice.
Mm-hmm.
How can that look in the world when journalists on the government payroll, by the government that was prosecuting these men, by journalists who were Cuban exiles, right-wing Cuban exiles, some of them are terrorists,
mm-hmm.
and the affidavit describes some of these journalists who have been convicted, some of them. Others that were convicted of placing bombs, of having bombs in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
others of saluting, glorifying Luis Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch, the ones who bombed the Cuban airliner and killing 73 people back in 1976. This is a horrendous case. And as Martin Garbus says, if there's not justice in this case, this will be a ghastly example of injustice in mm-hmm. the United States.
Yeah, it is so dramatic. I mean, by the way, one of those attending this conference is going to be Livio De Selma. He is the brother of Fabio De Selma, who was killed by a bomb placed by terrorists in a Havana hotel, and that was masterminded by Mr. Carriles, who lives, as I understand it, freely and is a local hero to the right-wing Cubans.
Yes, and one of the journalists who was paid by the government and who covered the case of the five, you know, in a harmful manner, his name is Enrique Encinosa. He's a very close friend of that bomber, Luis Posada Carriles. And there is a video of this journalist, Enrique Encinosa, who's a news director of the most powerful Spanish language radio station in Miami. Enrique Encinosa is on video on the internet saying, well, those bombs, you know, the one that killed Livio's brother, Fabio, he says, if those bombs can affect tourism and harm it, well, I think it's great. So this is one of
those. They've been shameless in this situation. By the way, we're both being very kind to call somebody a journalist who embraces terrorists. And I want to ask you about that, too. Again, this is Gloria LaRiva, and she's going to be attending our conference here in Toronto on September 21st through the 23rd. You know, both political parties, the major parties in the United States, have turned this issue of fighting terrorism into their most sacred doctrine. And the struggle against terrorism, as I recall when it was initiated, was that it's indivisible. You know, in other words, all the world has to unite in a civilized form to fight terrorism. Here you have Mr. Carriles walking free, and then you have the five. Who were trying to fight terrorism, and there had been cases of terrorism against their country, and they're not freed, and they're their courage actually respected, that they had done the right thing.
Yes, and I think we need to really keep in mind, this is about 5 men, as you said, Geraldo Hernandez, who has double life, and Ramon Lavallino, who has 30 years sentence, of Antonio Guerrero, who still has several years left to serve if we don't find justice before, of Fernando Gonzalez, who has 3 more years left, and of Rene Gonzalez, who was freed last October, with, you know, in quotation marks, but he's still in the United States because the judge will not let him go home. She has imposed a 3-year probation sentence, another part of his unjust sentence, and not allowing him to go home to his family. He has to remain basically underground. He can't even get a license to drive because he can't let the terrorists know where he lived. He would be giving up his address if he applied for a license. Mm-hmm. That's just part of this whole case of political persecution of the five by the U.S. government in Miami. It's not just Miami. The U.S. government finances these groups. The government has these paid agents. You're right. They're not journalists. They're paid agents of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And keeps financing radio and TV marquees.
Mm-hmm. No, it is such a striking story. By the way, look at, you have two presidential campaign going on. This is a disgraceful episode in American history, and no one will put this matter to these candidates, and I assume they're both united as one on in their approach to the matter. It's rather striking.
It's because of the vote when it comes down to it with Florida, which is often a swing state, but it's also because both parties, for these 50-plus years of the Cuban Revolution, have been determined to try to overthrow the revolution. The blockade keeps getting tightened more and more, and the U.S. pressures other governments, fines foreign banks for doing transactions with Cuba. It's an all-out press against Cuba, and the five who were working to protect Cuba at a time when the terrorism was on the rise in the 90s because of the development of tourism for Cuba to survive the mm-hmm. collapse of the Soviet Union and its trading partner, the U.S. has done everything they can to try to thwart Cuba's democracy and sovereignty, and the five are part of that struggle. So the election campaign right now means that there's not much coverage of the presidential candidates. Obama and Romney won't mention the five, and yet this is the time to be fighting. By the way, there's an interesting point. There was a senator, Ted Stevens, in 2008, who was convicted on corruption charges.
Mm-hmm.
To make a long story short, it turned out that the government prosecution had hidden some evidence that could have weighed in his favorably in his case. And when it was discovered 2 years later, Eric Holder, the current attorney general, stepped into the court process and ordered a new trial. Basically, he was found mm-hmm. innocent then, because the trial was, and there was never a new trial. The government stopped prosecuting him, and we're demanding, with a much larger, massive misconduct by the government, by the prosecution, we demand that Eric Holder take action too, step into this process and free these men.
Yeah, do the right thing.
Yeah, and that's part of what we're exposing and asking mm-hmm. the public of Canada, the U.S., and worldwide to visit the website, freethefive.org, sign on to receive the emails, read the information, and contact us if you can get more publicity about this, have forums. There's all kinds of things that can be done to let more and more people know. Mm-hmm. This Wednesday, there are hundreds of demonstrations, actions planned all over the world in dozens of U.S. embassies and consulates in the world. People are planning to have protests. All of this gives pressure.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Miami with dozens of other supporters in 2009, and Antonio Guerrero and two of the other five were resentenced, their sentences were reduced. And when Antonio was in court, the prosecutor, Carolyn Heck Miller, admitted essentially that the government has been feeling the pressure of this world movement for the five, even though sometimes you just can't tell that it's happening. And she said, "Your Honor, we have agreed, the defense and prosecution, to the reduction of sentence for Antonio Guerrero because we believe it will help calm the waters, the turbulent waters that are swirling around this case. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing thing to hear in court. We have to keep that in mind.
Indeed.
That every little thing that's done does help.
Yeah. Well, certainly this is going to help, and you're going to have Danny Glover. He's a really outstanding, very courageous and gifted man who's going to be attending. That shows that people are really, if they hear the truth, they're going to do as you say, to demand action on behalf of their governments. Gloria, we're very grateful for you taking the time, and we look forward to seeing you here on September the 21st or the 23rd.
Oh, thank you. And Cindy Sheehan will be there, other Canadian activists and wonderful people who've been keeping the flame going in Canada and Quebec. And thank you so much, Bill. Again, readafive.org, and you'll be given the information for the conference, right?
Yes, I have the information in front of me. I'm going to read it, and we'll be reminding people. So we're very grateful, and we look forward again to seeing you, and I'll bet it's going to be a successful conference. It's going to be at City Hall in Toronto, and that's great.
Great. We thank you. Take
okay.
good care.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye. That's Gloria LaRiva, and she is with the Free the Five National Committee in the U.S., and as I mentioned, coming from the U.S. will be also the lawyer Richard Klug will be here. Danny Glover is going to be here. Cindy Sheehan from Cuba, Adriana Perez and Elizabeth Palmiero, wives of the Cuban Five, will be in attendance. From the U.K., Tom Woodley, who is the executive officer of for Unite the Union, which is my understanding is the largest union in Britain, and I've seen him here previously at the Steelworker Hall in Toronto. A terrific individual, and it's great that he's behind this cause. From Venezuela, Julian Rivas, journalist and editor of El Mundo de Caracas, is going to be here, and this is in Toronto, breaking the silence, the untold story of the Cuban Five, and it's going to begin on Friday, September the 21st. At 11 a.m., there's going to be a press conference at Metro Hall on John Street at 6:30. Registration at the Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil Street at 7 p.m. There'll be an opening ceremony at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. Saturday, September 22nd, the People's Tribunal from 8 a.m. to 8:45. There will be registration at Toronto City Hall Chamber at 8:45 to 4 p.m., People's Tribunal, Toronto City Hall Council Chamber. And there will be a march and rally at the U.S. Consulate on University Avenue at 4:30 on the 22nd, September 22nd. It's a lot of stuff going on and a lot of great individuals involved. And on Sunday, September the 23rd, the People's Assembly will begin at 10 a.m. and it'll be at Toronto City Hall's Chamber. And at 1:30 to 4:30 p.m., there's going to be meetings and discussions and workshops on how to advance to before the public the case of the Cuban Five. And it will be available, the full program will be available at times of registration. So that all begins on the Friday, the September 21st, beginning at 11 a.m., Metro Hall, John Street. So again, we're very grateful for Gloria LaRiva talking to us today about this, and it's going to be quite an occasion. We're going to speak now with Robin Philpott. He is a Quebec publisher and the magic word in the contemporary parlance, he's an activist, which means he's an expert and knows everything. Trust him completely. How are you doing, Robin?
Well, I'm fine. I hope everybody trusts me completely.
Well, you know that we do see this, that if you want to know what's going on in Syria, the Toronto Star says you talk to an activist, he might be anywhere, and by golly, you can believe that activist. So I think we should borrow the word and we should all become activists so that we have gravitas.
It's very interesting to see that now all of a sudden activists can be
authorities.
Seen as reliable sources.
Absolutely, authorities. You want military, history, they can do it all.
Yeah, right.
Well, you got to do it for us. Tell us, let's start with the student demonstrations, which was the backdrop to your recent election.
Right.
I said on the air, I believe is the largest student strike in the history of North America. And people thought, speculated how this was going to improve or damage the political chances of the parties of Quebec. Can you talk about those two things?
It was the single most influential element in the election campaign. And what is probably most striking, and if you sort of like you dig through all the fog of analysis and talk, is that it was a clear victory for the students. The students, without that student movement, it would have been a mess, this election. It was all kind of messy as it turned out, but at the end of the day, it's a clear victory.
Amazing victory. I mean, by the way, I have to just interrupt and say, who remembers a student movement getting involved in elections? Politician decided to make, Mr. Sharim decided to make this an election issue. He decided to be very harsh with the students and bringing in very oppressive legislation on right to demonstrate, and rolled the dice thinking, to coin a phrase from Mulroney, thinking he was going to win that gamble.
Yeah, and he didn't win. What happened with the student is that the student movement helped the Parti Québécois, who won the election, to clear things up in its own camp, because it was sort of trying to straddle, you know, the what cannot be straddled, that is a right-wing and a left-wing agenda at the same time. And it was forced the Parti Québécois to take a position, and it took a relatively good position throughout the spring. And the government, the premier Charest, decided to attack on this issue. That's how he was starting. He attacked the leader of the Parti Québécois because she had the nerve to wear the red square. And
they ran video, we all saw it, of Madame Mawa beating on a pan. By the way, I think you're a self-confessed pan beater, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I do it all the time. And and of course, they tried to make that issue. And she, to the credit of the Parti Québécois, they didn't waver on it. They won the election, and the first thing, within 24 hours of winning, the first thing she said is, we have abolished the tuition increase, and we're going to remove that special back-to-school legislation, everything that involved with preventing demonstrations and that kind of stuff. So
the two things, in other words...
Yeah, she had a third one about the language issue as well, but she just came right out and said it, which was to her credit, because she could have tried to fudge and So I mean, today, yesterday, but it was in the news this morning, the two of the student organizations said, this is a victory. The student strike is over. Now we're going to prepare for the summit, which they also undertook to organize, to decide what is the role of universities in our mm-hmm. society. You know, this whole question of merchandization, privatization of the universities and so on. So they're working on that. And the third organization, which is the biggest, the CLASS, which you could say was the backbone of the movement, they said, we are very interested in that. We're still very glad that the PQ has abolished the tuition and the law. But we're going to hold a demonstration on the 22nd of September, because we're still in favor of free secondary, post-secondary schooling, yeah. And we want to prepare for this summit. So, you know, it's
that's very interesting. By the way, that's a big bite. You know, when they started out, it was freeze. You know, no tuition
group
increase.
Always stood for eventually winning free
yes.
post-secondary schooling. So.
Sure. Oh, by the way, I'm all in favor of that, and I recall Noam Chomsky sent them one of the most important messages, saying,
sure.
Yes, it can be done.
It
is done, he said, in Europe and South America. You have places where it's done.
Yeah.
But also, you know, you were talking about Mr. Charest and Marois. He was sent to Quebec with a neo, what is called the neoliberal model. Not that I know what the words mean, but anyhow, we all know it meant business-oriented.
Yeah.
And that the problem in Quebec was that they were still daydreaming, as Jean Chrétien likes to call it, about a sovereignty and also about a different kind of economic model. And he, so he had the twin jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now he seems to have faltered.
Well,
I guess it's time to change the quarterback.
Yeah, he came out smiling because he got what he wanted. He'll get congratulated because he came out with a relatively good show. He was chased out of power. But nicely. In other words, he managed to hold a certain number of seats. So
he didn't end up third.
But the bottom line is that he was chased out of power on this issue.
Yes.
The sovereignty issue has come back to the fore,
mm-hmm.
and the student movement, and you might say what was linked to the student movement was also management of natural resources, because they were overlapping a lot. In other words, you know, we had the Earth Day demonstration, was like 250,000 people. There was a mixture of the student issue, which was probably up front, but it also had to do with the way the natural resources are being exploited and developed, which people are very much against. In other words, they're saying the population has to get in on this. It can't just be given away to these multinationals.
Mm-hmm.
So he got chased out of power,
yes.
Charest, which is, you know, those demonstrations every night. As I was saying, I remember I was telling you one day, we just all throughout the spring we would say, "Well, I guess I'll go to a demonstration tonight," and you'd be there with 10,000 people, very on a regular basis. Regularly, like people.
I don't know any other place on this. Certainly not on this continent.
It was exciting,
that
and
magnitude.
It was an exciting period, but now you could say that the results have been successful. In other words, you know sometimes people say, why do we demonstrate? What does it result in? Well, here you have the students won. One of the student leaders, one of the three, has been elected.
Talk about him. He beat a cabinet minister, right?
Yeah, he beat one of the hardline cabinet ministers who was involved in negotiations.
And this was a student leader.
He's 20 years old, head of the college, federation. His mandate was over in 1st of July, and then he decided to run for the PQ, and he beat, it was a hot fight, you know, for the riding, and he won, and beat the government.
Don't play. That is not our style of student politics.
No,
who ever heard of this? A 20-year-old taking on a cabinet minister. On a really substantive issue involving every citizen of Quebec,
yeah.
and winning it.
Yeah. No. It is really a striking thing, as it use a word or play on words. It's like there is. I want to tell people about. There's a business book has come out. It's a book of pictures, photo book. But what it was a very smart job of a publisher. They invited people to send short texts of 100 words or less about, you know, who'd taken part in the demonstration and so on. And so it's done. The photographer from Le Devoir, a guy named Jacques Nadeau, who I saw regular at these demonstrations, well, he has some of these tremendous pictures of the whole spring, you know, and including government people. We remember there was that video that came out about Charest at the Desmarais.
Is that still available? People should see that.
Yeah, but that, one of the pictures in there shows.
This is like Marie Antoinette and her friends.
Yeah, but they had a conference here, and there you see the premier Charest, his finance minister, sitting there a bit depressed, and right in front of them is Paul Desmarais lecturing them. And this book of pictures of photos of the spring. It's called Carré Rouge, which means the red square,
mm-hmm.
and a brilliant book. It's really in fact, Phil, I will buy one and send it to you.
Oh, so please do. We hold up the pictures on our radio show so that people can see.
No, but it is something. it's a great record of of the event.
We're all addicted now to the internet. I know a lot of these things can be found, and people with the slightest diligence. I did see. I recall that that soiree with Sheree and all the powerhouse people, all very well dressed, and miles from where the locals hang out. Mm-hmm. And what an amazing thing. And you didn't need any sound, or you just looked at them.
Sure, exactly. No, exactly. But this book, it's a collector's item, I think.
If you would, please, because we'd like that. I mean, definitely, we would like to tell people how to access it.
Yeah, it's something that you want to keep because it shows... It shows throughout the period, you know, the big periods, the big demos, the small demos, the actual courage of the students, because you have to give it to them. They sustained it for months and months and months, you know, until they won.
Absolutely, and it got transformed when the attacks came from Sheree, who you know, he sort of had a kind of, in a way, football coaches put X's and O's on the board. He thought, okay, we say no to the students. When they demonstrate, we bring in the police, and then it's all over.
Yeah.
We get elected. However, the students and their families took to the streets and said, we don't like you on either point.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
And the family?
He didn't count on that.
No, he certainly didn't. So it's... Now it's going to be extremely a challenging period. If Madame Marois did not try and put sovereignty right up front, or it is up front, and if only also because her adversary, the enemies and adversaries have decided to put it up front.
People don't understand that the sovereignty issue is with the beginning of Canada till now.
Yeah.
Because there has to be a contractual relationship between the two nations.
Exactly.
And people want to run away from that and try to redefine it, but there is an understanding. And if the understanding is violated, you will have the issue of self-determination.
Right.
And it can't be escaped. You can't talk about, she promised. Or, you know, it all depends on how she's treated by the federal government, which seems to be a government all full of surprises. On a given morning, it seems to wake up grumpy and say strange things about Iran. You never know what they're going to do.
Right.
So she has the same problem in dealing with them.
Right.
They're very unpredictable.
And I think it's going to be demanding for people like ourselves who want to keep abreast and want to do things on a principled manner. I mean, you're going to have a lot of people. I've read articles in Toronto and... where people just getting carried away, you know, and it's something where people are going to have to sort of sit down and look at what the principles are, as you say, before they speak up.
What was it, the old cartoon of Levesque, after being elected, said, everybody take a Valium?
Right.
Everybody calm down. Because, of course, he was committed to a democratic process. Turned out his adversary wasn't, and we'll go into that again someday, about all the tricks that got played.
Right.
Has always been coming out of Ottawa, some really nasty ones, including spies inside the Levesque government.
Yeah, and I think it's we can expect this to go on, and it's going to take, it's going to take very smart, to see when it's a red herring. There's going to be a lot of attacks on Quebec,
mm-hmm.
and I think that we're going to have to know how to take them apart.
Indeed. Oh, that's why we're happy to have an activist in Montreal, because we know that we can count on you to help us out with it. Last thing, again, this is Robin Philpott, a publisher, and Baraka Books, a wonderful publishing house, brought out Ishmael Reed, who we had on this program, and many others, very important writers.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make to know about this student one more time. Is he going to be in the cabinet, do you suppose?
I don't think he will.
And
he,
can you? We're not using his name. What is his name?
His name is Léo Bureau Blouin.
Blouin.
Blouin. He's got the compound last name, mm-hmm. where you have father and mother's name. But it's Léo, is his name, Léo,
mm-hmm.
Bureau Blouin. I doubt if he will, because, during the campaign...
He's a 20-year-old student. He's probably got other things he'd like to do.
Well, not only that, no. What the... during the campaign... there's this guy Legault running for the Coalition Avenir Québec, was running for this coalition, so-called coalition. He started saying, well, such and such is going to be my Minister of Health and so on. And I think Madame Marois said, well, and they asked her to answer, what ministry is Leo Bureau-Blouin going to have? And she said, I don't think he will be a minister yet. That's all. So I doubt
we'll
if she
would,
you know, it just, I think we've got to learn some of the tricks, you know. Not some of the tricks, but...
I learned how to jump rope. Yeah.
You know, but also, you know, it's...
By the way, was he the only student elected, I should ask?
I think so.
Were there others who ran? Would you know?
No.
Yeah.
No other student leaders ran.
Yeah.
Student
well, leaders. It's a great story. It's like that of Mario Savio in California, who unfortunately did not get elected to be a member of the legislature. It would have been a great addition.
Yeah.
Robin, we really appreciate it very, very much. We will be, of course, having to get back to you very soon because we now have a new government and everybody's very nervous about it. So
and people are going to want to know answers to difficult issues that are going to be raised by your media. So
yes.
We'll keep trying, you know, we'll try and be able to answer those questions, honestly.
Yeah, very good. That's all we ask. Well, thank you, Robin Philpott.
Thanks, bye.
Bye-bye. And that's Robin Philpott. I guess we'll take a break. And then we're going to come back to talk to Stephen Gowan to see if we can figure out what this is with going on with Canada and Iran. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM. You can check us out on the web at Taylor-Report.com. And we take on all the issues we can. We're going to be speaking shortly with Stephen Gowans, and our listeners will know it's been gone around the world that the Canadian government, out of the blue actually, that's blue, I got the color right, has decided that to break off basically relations. I mean, they've closed the Iranian embassy in Canada and ordered Canadian diplomats home, and this has people very uneasy, and we'll be asking Stephen Gowans about that, and I believe we have Stephen on the line. Are you there, Stephen?
I'm here. Good afternoon, Phil.
Well, it's sure good to talk to you. This is a this matter of what's happening with this the bolt from the blue decision by the government. And I guess I'll start with this odd expression from the Prime Minister. They said, well, what do you think Iran will do now? He said, and his response was, well, nothing would surprise me. Now, he's the one who actually has surprised a lot of people. we seem to, Canadians woke up to what for them was a surprise. So he seems to like surprises. What do you think is behind this? What do you think is going on here?
What's going on? Well, I mean, it could be a number of things. It's difficult to say exactly what's going on. What seems to be clear, however, is that the proffered reasons for severing diplomatic relations with Iran are not believable. I mean, they're all being dismissed, and people are speculating as to the real reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be interesting to inquire into why it is that people have dismissed the mm-hmm. government's
problem. By the way, have you heard any sharp questions from the other parties? You would think they would all immediately want to know what, because this some of the speculation involves, is there prior knowledge of a possible conflict, violent conflict?
Yes, and that, one of the former Canadian ambassador to Iran, John Mundy, I mean, raises that possibility that, you know, Ottawa is pulling its diplomats out of the country in anticipation of a unilateral Israeli strike. And, you know, that could be, since Canada has offered unqualified support to Israel. I mean, Canadian diplomats would be in danger if Israel followed through on its many threats to attack Iran. And that's, you know, we should note that the Canadian government said that the reason that it was severing relations or diplomatic relations with Iran was because Iran is the most significant threat to global peace and security in the world today, and presumably is a threat to Israel, Mm-hmm. Yet it is Israel that is, you know, unremittingly threatening or daily calling for, clamoring for an attack on Iran and threatens to undertake one itself.
Yes. Yeah, certainly their prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, by the way, he has an interesting rhetorical record on this. I mean, he goes back some 10, 15 years using expressions like, well, we have a window of opportunity if we don't act now. And that was 15 years ago, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do need some sober assessment. We have a situation where Mr. Romney, who would be the ideological close friend of Mr. Harper, he says the Russians are number one. And now Mr. Harper says, well, it's Iran is number one, and I'm going to close the embassies. I mean, you know, we're seriously irrational here. And irrational behavior and thinking can have consequences maybe people don't appreciate.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of something that Michael Parente has said, which is that countries like the United States and Canada divide the world into two. I mean, there are those countries which are friendly, which are subordinate to the United States, and everyone else is an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But why are they an enemy? I mean, they're an enemy because they're not willing to become extensions of the U.S. or Western economic interests.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting to inquire or to look at the reasons that Ottawa has given for severing its relationships with Iran. Because this is a huge double standard here. I mean, as I mentioned already, trying to argue that Iran is a threat to world peace without mentioning the fact that it's Israel that seems to be the biggest threat to world peace.
Well, yes, he says non-compliance with, he makes it as, it's as though they actually are the Ministry of Information and we don't have any other information. They say the United Nations, they have to comply with United Nations, but the United Nations has also asked Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it refuses to do. They've also asked for disclosure about their bombs, which everybody says they've got, but no disclosure. So, but when they talk about it as if we're not supposed to be aware of these things, we're all supposed to pretend we don't know these other details.
Yes, and so, which is why that the reasons that they've cited are completely unbelievable. I mean, one of them is that Iran provides military assistance to the Syrian government or as a human rights violator. But, you know, if Ottawa were genuinely concerned about the world's worst violators of human rights giving military assistance to tyrannical regimes, it would have shut its embassy in Saudi Arabia long ago.
Or the one in Washington.
Or the one in Washington, yes. Or in innumerable places. In Tel Aviv, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, we're being asked to play along with the strangest things. This, by the way, this is Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.org. Am I right?
WordPress.com.
WordPress.com. And the incidentally, in your most recent writing, you talk about the role of the. You have an excellent analysis of the situation, the assessment of Iran. You point out, you use a rather funny. Point. You say that Ralph Miliband, who is the darling of the British Labour Party as a thinker, what he advocates in the way of running an economy, you say, is pretty much what Iran has as a model.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in Iran, the Constitution says that there's a private part of the economy, a market-driven part, and there's also a state-owned part. I mean, Miliband always said that a kind of socialist society that he envisioned would be one in which there would be a large state sector, but there would also be a private market-driven sector. But in Iran, according to the Constitution, the market or the private economy exists to serve the state sector.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the private economy is subordinate to public policy goals, which is kind of the model that Miliband set out for Western socialist societies, the kind he envisaged.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of states like that that are in the crosshairs of the United States. Syria is like that as well. I mean, Syria has a very large state sector.
Yes.
Syria has its own style of socialism as well. And same, too, in certain respects with Libya. So when you go through this list of countries that have been targeted by the United States, Yugoslavia, too, I mean, a social democracy, all of these countries seem to have put public policy goals ahead of Wall Street's goals, and that appears to be really what's motivated Washington.
Yeah. By the way, in your writings, you've put your finger on that. They've specified, it's not a secret either, that when they talk about their concept of what a proper Republican democracy is, it involves very strongly the idea of private property and freedom of corporations to operate as they wish. I know it was from your previous writings. And by the way, I'll just say again, it's gowans.wordpress.com.
They always say democratic free market societies.
Yeah. So the reform, for example, now everybody's trying to mug, I want everybody, the Gulf monarchs and Washington, London, Paris want to mug Syria. And they keep saying, well, we won't get reforms, so we get rid of this guy. But when they say reforms, that's what they mean, right? I mean, that's the content. It would have to be a free market operation.
Yeah, and no one really cares whether it's democratic or not. I mean, as evidenced by the fact that...
I know the emir of whatever it is doesn't.
That's right. I mean, Bahrain, an absolute monarchy. I mean, these countries, these Gulf monarchies that abominate democracy, I mean, they're... certainly the United States has no intention of overthrowing their government. Mm-hmm. And never will, because these governments are certainly friendly, congenial to U.S. corporate interests.
Yeah. This is Stephen Gowans, and let me remind, ask you this, Stephen. In terms of the rhetoric, and they've listed a priority of safety of the diplomats. They say they don't think that they could be safe any longer, though there has been no issues that I'm aware of with those Canadian personnel. But I noticed that everyone seems to have forgotten, or there's no reference to the fact, that the Iranian embassy in Ottawa was assaulted. A party of people associated with the so-called terrorist movements in Iran versus the Islamic Republic climbed over the fence and broke into the embassy, and they attacked the ambassador of Iran and broke his arm. Uh-huh. Has everybody forgotten? It strikes me, you would think that the editorialist might look back and say, well, that was an odd moment, wasn't it? And CSIS personnel were there and observed it but did not interfere. Because they said, well, that's not their mandate, you see. They're not police officers. So they observed the assault on an embassy in which the people took papers, burned things, and physically attacked people in the Iranian embassy in Ottawa.
Uh-huh.
I think the Iranians are rather patient. They seem to understand what diplomacy is. You put a man in a country that doesn't like you, and he puts his man in your country, and they're there to facilitate the movement of people and maybe communication so that you can try to work out your differences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to lecture so much, but you recall that, right, that assault?
Yes, I do. And so, in other words, I mean, the same kind of thing that happened last November when protesters in Tehran stormed the British embassy there, and then Britain... withdrew its diplomats, who've been withdrawn since.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, you're right. And but as you say, I mean, this could signal or Canada playing it safe and expecting that Iran is about to launch a unilateral strike on Iran. And if that were to happen...
I'm sorry, did you mean, was that Israel or...
Israel, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And if that were to happen, given that Canada certainly aligned itself strongly with Iran, I think it's legitimate to say that Canadian diplomats would be in danger.
Yeah.
But, you know, another possibility is that Canada is participating in an Israeli-sponsored ruse to ratchet up psychological pressure on Tehran.
Yes, and I wonder, by the way, is it possible the U.S. Might be directing this? It occurred to me that if they're not just deranged, if they talk this over, that they might be a stalking horse. You know, in other words, as you say, to ratchet it up. Because at the moment, Mr. Obama and his friends are all saying, well, we don't really want to see any big blow-up here around the time of the elections, et cetera. But I think we have to assume, don't we, that they would have been talking to each other, we're going to do this, and somebody in Washington said, go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to act without the approval, mm-hmm. implicit or otherwise, of Washington. And certainly Israel has been doing a lot recently to ratchet up that psychological pressure to the point where Tehran has said, yeah, we don't even believe you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlikely that you'll attack us at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, quite a psychological game going on at the moment, and mm-hmm. Ottawa might be participating in it on behalf of Israel and the United States.
Yeah. This is Stephen Gowans, who about a minute ago, and Stephen, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, Stephen, about the Syria matter. I get the impression that that the U.S. and friends have decided to be in it in the long haul in the kind of dirty way that they were in Afghanistan and elsewhere, where people are supplied with weapons. It's not a real war. They just begin to set off cars and bombs and things. But would you think they maybe are slowly losing in this battle?
The rebels?
Yes.
Well, they're certainly not winning, that's for sure. I don't know. This could go on for quite some time. But what strikes me as really interesting about the Syrian matter is that these kind of civil war between the secular forces and the Islamic forces are part of Syrian. And there's been a long-standing war, sometimes, you know, overt, sometimes covert, between the Syrian government and the Muslim Brotherhood. And this seems to simply be a continuation of it, except that the West now has intervened more strongly on the side of the rebels.
Mm-hmm. And the UN configuration is starting to a little bit shift with vetoes being used against intervention.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather promising prospect, I suppose. Stephen, we're really grateful that you gave us the time. We look forward to talking to you again about all this. You have a great website, gowans.wordpress.com.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
bye.
And you've been listening to the Taylor Report, and I'm Phil Taylor. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Check us out, taylor-report.com. And don't forget that the Breaking the Silence conference is going to begin in Toronto for the Cuban Five on September 21st at Toronto City Hall. And thanks to Barbara. We'll see you next week.
Hey, U of T, the University of Toronto Students Union.